This is the Perfectly Mentored Podcast with your host, Jason Portnoy.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Perfectly Mentored. I'm your host, Jason Portnoy. My guest today is the amazing, super talented, globally recognized fashion designer, Rebecca Minkoff, someone who left and moved to New York City at the age of 18 in the pursuit of becoming a fashion designer. In 2001, right after 9/11, she launched the I Love New York t-shirt collection and was seen on The Tonight Show and just became an overnight global sensation. I'd say overnight lightly because she's put in 20 years of work into her business, so I don't want to do that. But today, Rebecca Minkoff is a global brand with a wide range of apparel, handbags, footwear, jewelry, timepieces, eyewear, and even a fragrance. She also even founded the Female Founder Collective, which is a network of businesses led by women who invest in women's financial power, and even becoming a certification where you could look at it and see which products have female founders. She's an incredible, super smart and savvy entrepreneur, and you're going to love this episode. Rebecca, welcome to the show. So great to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being wanting to talk to me.
Thanks for wanting to talk to me. I think you have it a little bit reversed there. For the listeners who may not know your background and your journey, why don't you give them a little insight to your, your entrepreneurial journey and how you got to build this global brand that you have?
Sure. So I had fallen in love with sewing and design when I was about 8 years old. I wanted a dress. It was a simple idea. It was a $20 dress in the store window. My mom refused to buy it for me, but said, I'll teach you how to sew it. And I was really pissed. I was like, buy me the damn dress, woman. But what it sparked was a love of sewing and design that carried through very seriously through high school, enrolling in an arts program that 4 hours of my day every day was costume design, draping, pattern making. And so when all the kids were kind of going off to school, I was like, I don't know if I want to do that. I think I want to go start working. So I secured a paid internship. And when I say paid, $4 an hour, just to put it in perspective, in New York City dollars, and moved to New York at 18. So I worked with this designer for about 3 years. And right after 9/11, the CEO said, either you're all in with me or you're going to go do your own thing. And I think you want to do your own thing, so go do it. And so she gently fired me. And that was the beginning of a 20-year journey.
So it's funny because if I know the story correctly, really, everything started to take off with the I Love New York shirt, right? Mm-hmm. So when I had a clothing brand, the success really started for me with one shirt, right? It was one shirt that caught on and went nuts. I was struggling with the brand before that one shirt took off. And then I was able to leverage it. So the same with you. How were you able to leverage that? I'm curious to know your story of how you were able to leverage that and not be like that one hit wonder or that one shirt and then fade out.
Yeah. So prior to launching the shirt, I had a very small 5-piece collection. It was between me and one other sewer, making everything ourselves, delivering it to these little boutiques across New York. And the shirt hit at a moment. It was right after 9/11. I had made it pre 9/11, sent it to this actress. She wore it. This was pre-social media. So the power that TV had, you know, being on Jay Leno, her saying my name, ignited this shirt. And that's all I did for 9 months was that shirt. But what I did was it opened the door for me to call more stores and more boutiques and say, I don't just have a shirt. I have, you know, a blouse, I have a dress, I have pants, will you see me? And so a lot of them frankly said, I know I've heard of you. I'm not sure how, but sure. But because they heard the name and seen it in Us Weekly 600 times and Lucky Magazine and whoever wrote about it, they were willing to take the meeting. And then it was up to me to break down that door. So, you know, for the better part of 4 years, I had I had the shirt, and then I had a very small, you know, business. I'd say at the high at that time, it was about $250,000, not making any money, couldn't pay the bills. But what happened was that same actress came back to me and said, do you do bags? And this was right at the time where I was like, I actually can't afford to live in New York. Do I give up my dream? or do I move back home? And when she said, do you do bags? I lied to her. I said, yes, I had two made. And when that bag hit, it was another one of those moments. Daily Candy wrote about it. The title of the article is called The Catwalk of Shame, because it was called The Morning After Bag. And so I was able to take one shirt, which lasted me kind of 4 years of getting my foot in the door, to a bag that gave me, you know, another 4 years. And then guess what happens? That bag dies out. And then you're like, okay, got to create the next one. And the story about the next one's even weirder. I walked by a store that had completely knocked me off, like down to the very last detail, but they shrunk the bag. They made it like this big instead of this big. And I was so pissed. I bought the bag and I was going to confront the store who carries my things and say, why are you copying me off? Why are you copying me if you're carrying me? And the president of my company at the time said, don't do that. Just make the bag and sell it for $195. That's how you're going to get even. You're going to make that bag that was shrunken and sell it for this incredible price. And we did it. And our business again, like, surged. So I feel like it's about these hits and how do you keep it going? And of course, everyone's always chasing a hit, but how do you find that item that strikes the right time and then pour the fuel onto that item?
There's so many lessons in all that, that I could go so many different directions here. Well, I want to talk the math side of things for a second, because I think everyone gets obsessed with revenue, right? How much revenue can I make? And it's almost like that's a vanity metric, because like you said, you're making $250,000+, and everyone starting a brand thinks, wow, I want to make $250,000 because then I can live life on my own terms. And they have no clue that no, you're so far from making any money off that. So, I mean, what do you tell entrepreneurs when all they focus on is revenue?
I tell them now something very different, related to lessons I learned. So just plain old, like, if we just take it simple, you're lucky if you net 10% of all that, because 250,000, half of it goes to production costs. You have to factor in taxes, right? There's all sorts of things that keep chipping away. So if you're lucky, you come out of that with $25,000 in profit, then add New York City to it. That doesn't buy you much in New York City as far as rent and food. In fact, I lived on $23,000 a year for many years, and it's almost impossible I ate ramen, and still, you know, I'll never forget Con Ed sitting outside my door saying, we're not leaving until you give us a check. So it does not go far in New York City. So I think what I tell people, we hit an inflection point in 2009 where it was like, do we go big as a brand and just who cares about a profit? Lots of brands were doing that. They were growing big. It looked sexy. Ooh, we're $1 billion. Or do we stay smaller and still grow, but profitably? We chose the big, sexy unicorn status, and you are pumping money that you don't have, or other people's money that you don't have, into a business where you're crossing your fingers and you're saying, if we get there, then we get the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And every decision we made as a company was factored around that. And then one very fine day, as we were getting all like excited about what our value was, every single investor we turned to said, are you profitable? No. Oh, well, we're only looking for profitable companies now. And so it was like turning the Titanic around to say, okay, how do we restructure the company to be profitable? So I say to any new entrepreneur, please make sure that you have product market fit. Please make sure that you have people that demand and want your product. Please make it profitable. I know it's sexy to be on the cover of a magazine, but it's not so sexy when you basically are answering to the people who invested in you and what they want to do. And it's not sexy when you own 2% of your company, as some big founders do who are on the cover of magazines. It's a lot sexier to say, we own the majority of our company. We control its destiny. We can pay ourselves well. We can live a nice lifestyle. So it's taken 10 years to right that wrong. And I think, you know, just beware. It's not all about what you see and what that means from the inside.
I agree. I have a follow-up on that. For the small businesses that are listening right now, advertising is super important, right? So it's an investment they need to make that they may not get anything out of, especially when you're proving a concept, especially when you want to test the market to see if there's a fit for it. How important is building a brand when it comes to success of your business or other business, or when you talk to entrepreneurs building businesses?
I think it depends. I think early on I was asked, do you want to be a designer or do you want to build a brand? And there's different behaviors if you're just trying to be a designer. I think you just operate differently. You market differently. How you get success translates differently. We decided we wanted to be a brand. So what did that mean? It meant that I was at the helm of the brand, but that we're not just about the designer. We're about a lifestyle. So what is that lifestyle? Who is that woman? Why does she buy into this? So we had to come up with, what are the pillars that the brand stands for? What are the where's the Venn diagram where I intersect into that? And so I think that depending on what you're building, a customer, no matter what, wants to know that the brand they're associating with means something more than just the product. You have Supreme. People go nuts for that brand. They can slap that label on a Band-Aid and people will buy it because of what Supreme means to them. So when you figure out what do you mean to the customer, that's when you can start building a brand around what those values are.
And so for you, how hard is it when it comes to building a brand around your name? Because you must be, when you have employees working for you and you're not involved in the day-to-day and something gets put out or something gets done, it's your name ultimately that gets out there. It's a brand. Your name's now a brand, but it's still you. How do you, intervene when it comes to things like that?
So I had to go through some cognitive dissonance with separating myself from the brand. I think when you have the right people in place, and we didn't for a long time, I'll never forget, a store came in and they wanted a laptop bag that said Nerd Alert on it. And I said, that's disgusting. And I would never do that. And our president at the time said, do you want the order for 5,000 units or not? Do you want me to go back and say we didn't make our numbers because we didn't do this? And I was like, whoa, I don't want that load. Okay, put Nerd Alert on the bag and let's see if it sells, right? And so that's a really tough thing to swallow, that you said yes to that and you let it happen and it doesn't tie back to the brand at all. Currently, we have an incredible woman at the helm and I can trust that she makes the right decisions. Now, does that mean that I'm going to wear and be the face of every single item we make? No. But a friend of mine, said this brand at the highest is you, and it becomes the most diluted version of you at the most commercial part of it. So as long as that dilution is true to the source, it's fine. I think when that dilution becomes something like, oh, that's horrific. Oh, I've made those faces at my product, then you know something's off. But if you can say, hey, for the woman who lives in North Dakota, no slight to North Dakota, who maybe isn't in a metropolitan city seeing the fashion, do I expect her to wear something that someone in New York or LA would wear? Not really. So what is that diluted still piece of the brand that still means something to her? Is it an earring? Is it a sweatshirt, right? And does it still have my stamp? Then great.
So going back a second, when you said, you got started in New York, and New York's a tough city. A lot of designers moved to New York in hopes of making it.
Yep.
So I guess what made you stand out in your mind? What do you think differentiated you from all the people who come in there with hopes and aspirations that don't see it to fruition?
I think the two biggest and most important things that you have to have as a skill set is the ability to ask for help, the ability to network and rely on people that are in this sphere to help you, and the ability to persist. We've had more holes in our boat than I've ever cared to imagine. Instances where you're just like, you cannot make this shit up. And people would run from those. Any normal person would run from some of the challenges we've had. And we just keep going. We say, this is just a barrier that we will overcome. And I think that I very quickly realized the power of whether it's the power of 6 degrees of separation or the ability of, oh, she knows someone who knows someone, and leaning on that. Cause I didn't know anyone when I moved to New York. I had this shoddy little website that would say fashion parties when they were, and I'd go to them with my business cards And then I met a girl who would take me to a bunch of parties and introduce me. And then, you know, and I was able to go good. I came home at night and I counted my business cards like they were cash, you know? And then I followed up with those resources and contacts and asked them. And so you have to be comfortable doing that. You cannot be a designer that gets to shy away in the back and never speak to anyone. And it's all about your art. That sounds wonderful, but it's just not true in today's day and age.
I think it's a business lesson and a life lesson, right? I don't think people ask enough for anything, period, right? If you want a sale, you have to ask for it. If you want that person to go out with you, you got to ask them, right? Everything begins with the ask. And, you know, when it comes to this podcast, having amazing guests like yourself, people always say, how do I get them? And I said, literally, I asked, right? Like, Rebecca, you'll confirm this. I DM'd you on Instagram and that's how it started, right? Like, it starts with an ask. The worst case, the worst thing someone could say is no, and you learn to deal with it. So, but that's a mindset, right? Everything you talked about is a persevering and going through it, which a lot of entrepreneurs, true entrepreneurs, I should say, not the ones who want to do it because they get to take pictures on a yacht or a private jet. But true entrepreneurs could persist and ride those lows and hammer through it. But that's a mindset. Did you always have that mindset, or was it something you had to learn or work on?
I think that I had that mindset for a long time because growing up, anytime I asked for something, the reply was, you have to earn it or figure it out yourself. So whether it was, you know, buying my first sewing machine, how are you going to pay for it? Whether it was going to summer camp, here are the forms, register yourself. For a second, I thought I wanted to homeschool because that's what my brothers were doing. And she's like, here's the website and the application, fill it out on your own. And so, you know, even at 16, I said, I want to go to New York City and see if it's where I want to live. And she's like, great, get yourself there and figure it out. And so that sort of primed me for that entrepreneurial mindset of, I don't know the answer, but I know how to figure it out. And I know I'm going to keep trying until I do.
And now you have three kids, right?
I have three kids. Yeah.
So I have two. How do you pass on? Do you pass on that same, like, how do you pass on that toughness to them?
So I'm in a weird spot with it, which is I want to give them the same experience that I had. And I was told no all the time. We're in a spot right now where I do say no a lot more often than I feel comfortable. Cause at the same time that I say no, I remember what it felt like as a kid and it sucked. So you're like cringing as you're saying no. And then sometimes it's just like, oh, fuck it. It's just easier to pick up the damn towel and clean up their laundry myself than like wait for them to do it and teach them how to do it. So I'm trying to get better about really sticking to it and being that annoying person that's like, put your dishes away, clean up your stuff. Oh, you want that shoe? Great. Do five chores around the house. But I think having grown up in New York City, they see a lifestyle that, you know, we have that they know there's a little bit of success there. And so when I am saying, no, you have to work for it, they don't believe me, if that makes sense. Whereas I believe my parents, like they weren't living lavishly. And I'm not saying we are, but they weren't living anything out of the ordinary. I just thought that was normal. So they see sort of, my kids see sort of like a dissonance, like, oh, mom bought something nice for herself. She could afford to buy it for me, but she won't. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So how do you reconcile that to them?
I tell them that I work my damn ass off and yes, I can buy myself something nice. And if they want nice things, they can buy it for themselves.
I love it. So for the entrepreneurs that are listening, what advice do you have for them, you know, on breaking through in, let's say, a saturated market? I mean, there are so many fashion brands out there, right? You broke through. There's so many, you can say that about almost any industry, right? There's so many other people. So what advice do you have for them on how they could break through that noise and I guess become a little plug for you, fearless, like you?
I think that you have to get granular on what you mean to these consumers and what they want from you. It is not a one-way street where you get to dictate anything. I think early on, we realized the power of listening to our customer. Obviously, that's done every day now. But rather than hoping there's a tool to do that for you and give you these analytics, go talk to them, go meet them, you know, begin a community. I have a friend who launched an intimates company, community first, these women were following her and signing up for shit that they didn't even know what it was going to be. But by the time she launched, they were so excited about the mission that she had, I think it was, she started with 100 ambassadors. Now she has 100,000 ambassadors that are almost like her, the proselytizers of her brand. So I think that you should get to know your customer, listen to their feedback. It's never easy. You know, you might say red, they might say black, and figure out that two-way dialogue and then come up with a product. I think so many people get overwhelmed. They have to launch a million things at once. Come up with one thing that works. Get really good at that. Once that's humming, add more. And make sure that you're following the same thing that got you that success. You know, was it the survey? Was it the customer? Was it the place? Was it how you launched? And then try testing stuff. I think we try testing a lot of things. Sometimes you'll see what we're doing on social and be like, why would she do that? We're testing. We're seeing where does she sort of land with it all? So I think as far as being fearless, everyone has fear. I have it. My book is called Fearless because I wanted to say there are no rules. Don't follow the old rules. You're going to have to create your own. And I think that for many entrepreneurs, you can look to how A, B, C, and D did it, but it's never going to be that linear of a path for you.
I read somewhere that now you're like, at least when COVID started, photo shoots were done and you were doing your own photos in your backyard.
Yes.
So I'm curious to hear from you. How do you think business as a whole, marketing as a whole, I guess two different areas have changed at the start of the pandemic, because you've been able to thrive and still get through and come out the other side? And how do you think it will forever be changed now that we move through this?
Yeah. So I think when obviously we had no resources, no people, couldn't do anything, everything defaulted to me. The reason why I was 1 minute late to our call is because I was just on the phone with my brother and he was like, I think that period is over. You know, we're a little bit too late in the DIY look. We have the ability to hire models now. We have the ability to get more creative. And so it's not that the pendulum is going to swing all the way back to what we did before. I think there's a happy medium. And I think at least for us as a brand, the things we thought we had to have, and by no means were they extravagant, but the things before we thought we had to have in order to be in business is not 100% the case. And what we did to stay alive doesn't necessarily still apply today. I think there's a middle ground where we're trying to say, okay, great. I don't need to be doing top of funnel videos in the backyard anymore, but what is another creative top of funnel that still is brand appropriate, but that's not this fancy like woman getting out of a jet. Not that we ever did that, but I think that no one wants to see that, right? So what is that realness that's not necessarily solely dependent on someone in their iPhone in the backyard?
So when you start with a product, right, started with the shirt, then a bag, and as you grow, how does the story of what the brand is about change, right? Because you start with a bag and you have a story, right? The morning after bag, you have a story of why you started it, but then how do you become a mission-based company, right? Which how do you tell that story of Rebecca Minkoff and have that mission when you start with the product? Like the story and mission had to have changed a bunch of times as you go through it. So how do you develop the story around the brand?
So if we go back, the one consistent thread other than a brief blip when we completely went AWOL is it's always been an aesthetic that was sort of bohemian and rock. Your bag was your hard piece. The clothing was flowier, more feminine. The shoes were your hard piece, right? And so that aesthetic, except for 1 9-month period where I went on maternity leave and placed all my trust into someone who completely took the brand in a different direction. We're back now. It's always been a consistent bohemian rock, free spirited, effortless, right? As the aesthetic, the woman's always been the same. She's been optimistic. She's been confident. She's been fearless. Doesn't mean she's not scared. Doesn't mean that you're not like, oh, I'm not confident. That's not who I am. Right. We want you to, just like you shared that story of your sister, like, I can't tell you how many times women come up to me and say, I got your bag because it was a celebration of my first job, graduation, marriage, baby, right? All these sort of pinnacle moments for a woman. So that's her mindset. Then we have to layer in on top the fact that I've always had it. It was always normal to me to have women in my company. And for that to be a majority, it wasn't something I had to strategize. It was just like, we're women selling to women. What does a man know about a ruffle? No offense to any men who love ruffles, but like, that was natural. And I began to see that that was not normal outside of my company and most industries. And so when I began to get, you know, the speaker tour circuit and it's me and the same five women on every panel, I'm like, there's 12 million women out there that have, you know, founded their companies. Why aren't all of them here? Why aren't they all represented? So the mission part became the fact that I was tired of us being treated like polar bears. And so how do we amplify all the success that women have? How do we support more founders so that I'm not an anomaly, that I'm not a unique story? I would love there to be 12 million, you know, which this is the number of female founded businesses in the US. I'd love them all to be having success. And I think that became something that the minute I could pour the coal on the platforms in order to show that became incredibly important, not just for me personally, but to my company and its values.
So let's talk about that. I think that's a perfect segue into the Female Founder Collective.
Okay.
Tell us a little bit more about that and why you believe so strongly in this.
So again, this was 2018 that I launched it. I felt alone. Again, I felt one of five women that gets to be participating in all these talks and chats and all that. I felt lonely within the design community. I didn't want to just go to a party and talk to an editor about what the latest person thought of the collection. And I thought there could be power in community. There could be power in each other's resources, our black books, our tips and tricks. And there could be power unlocked in the education that we don't get when we go into business with a passion, right? You don't learn all these things until you learn the hard way when something fails. So my co-founder joined me back at the end of 2018, and we really wanted to build a vibrant community that had education, that had founders supporting each other, and that had a seal. You know, as a consumer, you probably look for certain symbols when you're buying your children's food. I know I do as a mother or a beauty consumer. And so could you just say on the back of X, you know, it's women owned. And so that's an easy, effortless way to support a women owned business. So we have the seal on roughly 3 million products to date. The community is about 9,000 strong. We're about to launch a very incredible paid membership portion of the program, because we feel like we're just scratching the surface of what we can do for these founders.
So then based off that, what's your advice to the women in business right now, or the entrepreneur, or the women, the female entrepreneurs that are getting started right now? If you could speak to all of them through this platform, this is a magical platform, and you're able to do it, what would you say to them? Because you're a badass, right? And I feel like you're 100% right. Even with this podcast, I'll be perfectly honest, it's hard to find women who want to come on and want to be vocal and want to speak and want to talk. You know, I feel like entrepreneurship in general has been male dominated, just a bunch of alpha males who could just talk the loudest. So what's your advice towards or to those females?
A couple of things. Sticking your neck out is never comfortable. And I'm going to make some extreme examples, but you know, Rosa Parks stuck her neck out to stay at the front of the bus, right? Or if you look at what people had to march about just to simply end segregation, none of that's comfortable. And so I think that sometimes women can default to this sort of mentality of it didn't happen for me, or I'm waiting for it to happen to me, second guessing themselves, making sure they have all their I's dotted and T's crossed in the hopes that one day if someone notices them, they will go out there. You have to forget all that. You have to put yourself out there. You have to be vocal. You have to be heard. If you're scared, practice with your friends, you know, till you get good at it. If you're raising money, make 100 appointments and make sure that the first 75 are the companies you'd never want to sell to, because you will get damn good at practicing your pitch, getting critical feedback with all the people you never want their money for. And so I think we have to take the bull by the horns. We have to create it ourselves, and we can't wait for anyone else to help us. And if we get people to help us along the ride, that's awesome. But no one's going to hand you the silver platter. I remember I wanted a silver platter. I was like, well, that designer look what happened to him. Anna Wintour loves him. He is friends with all the cool models. Cool brands want to work with him. When is that going to happen to me? And then I woke up one day, I was like, it's never going to happen to me. I have to do it. And there's no one else, if it's my business, it's going to care as much as I do about it happening. So whether that feels shitty or not, you got to pull on your pants and be like, okay, how am I going to create this?
Wrap up with this, because I think that was an amazing answer. And I don't want to even go further in that, because I think that was perfectly said. How important is mentorship to learn from the greats? This show is called Perfectly Mentored. How important was that to your success and you know, your advice towards other people who want to seek out mentors?
So I think that mentorship has taken on the wrong tone and word. I can't tell you how many people approach me pre-COVID, but now DMing me, will you mentor me? Can I just have 15 minutes with you? And I'm like, no, that's not how you're going to get successful. You are going to get successful by learning with your peers who are next to you. You're going to get more successful if you go into your company and you go, what is the job I would never want to have? Great. Let me go have coffee with that person. Let me learn what their job is about. I think there's been this default mentality of like, I'm just starting out. Let me go to the CEO. Maybe they'll give me this on a silver platter. You have more to learn from a mid-level manager at that company than any CEO, because they haven't touched whatever that person is doing in the last 10 years. And their perspective is going to be so far away from what you're about to enter into that it's just going to set you up to fail. Cause you'll be like, oh, I could just be like that. No, you can't just be like that. You have to work for 10, 15 years to figure that out. So look for the jobs you hate. Find the mid-level managers or the entry-level people if you're just starting out. Find people that are in adjacent industries that maybe could teach you something. That's where the real beauty of mentorship comes. And yes, we can be inspirational, but I don't think I could be as helpful as someone in my company for that job that you need and want mentorship on, if that makes sense.
100%. And there's two things with that. One is they, depending on where they're at in their business, they may not even know the right questions to ask you. Right? Like they don't know the right questions. Like let's say you said yes, unique opportunity. You said yes. They're going to come in with questions that they should not be asking. Right. Correct. So they're coming in with the wrong questions. That, and I always go back to conferences when I look at people starting off and they attend conferences and they always want to go after the speaker, and they only, yes, when everyone around you is probably way more suited to mentor you or give you advice than the speaker based off the level you're at.
100%. I every conference I've spoken at, there's a long line and I'm just like, oh my God, my publicist is right there. You should probably ask her about PR. Or, you know, back in the day, if my assistant came with me, which is rare, ask her, you know, how does she manage a schedule? You know, I think there's this quick, get quick rich that is seeped into our culture, whether it's you get your Uber immediately, you get your Amazon immediately.
The instant gratification.
Yeah, like you're going to be successful and famous overnight. And you're going to get it by talking to me or you. And that's just not how it happens. It's taken me 20 years to sit with you in my parents' guest bedroom and sleep in a bunk bed. Okay.
overnight success and entrepreneurship at its finest, right?
Yes.
Perfect. Rebecca, thank you so much for doing this. For the listeners who want to reach out, not to be mentored, but just to follow you on your journey, how can they follow you?
So they can listen to my So they can listen to my podcast. It's called Super Women with Rebecca Minkoff. I interview incredible women that'll just make you go, yep, they failed. They got back up. I can too. My book Fearless comes out June 15th. So you can pre-order it anywhere books are sold. And follow me on Instagram at Rebecca Minkoff.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And for the listeners, the first five people that take a screenshot showing that they're following Rebecca, I'll give them the first five books. So there you go.
Thank you.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for paying attention and tuning into that episode. If you enjoyed it, please do me a favor. Go leave a 5-star review, leave a review, leave some comments, share it with some friends, spread the love. It would mean the world to me. Thank you so much for your attention and for tuning in, and I will see you on the next episode.